which is the name I can't think of. And I know the director of engineering over there was impressed with the gadget, which was a high-speed RF modulator for 1,030 megahertz.
Which sounds related to ISF, 1,030 megahertz. Yeah, that sounds like an ISF-like system. ISF, tack-in, not VOR. Huh. Yep. I do remember there being a company in Great River. When Grumman owned them for a short chunk of concrete with wire lashing on top of it to represent a very good ground plane for vertical antenna, among other things on their antenna range. Does that ring a bell, Doug? W2SAY, K2IW.
Probably something I never really realized. I just remember a very long RASI range. As I say, with a tower at one end, or you could put your horn on the ground at the far end, and there was a small tower, not exactly a tower, a raised platform, where you could put your transmitting antenna, or your receiving antenna. Whoops, are we still on there? I better let up for a minute.
You're still on the air, don't worry.
Okay. I think, I'm not sure, but I think that Grumman had left before this company took over.
Sounds right. You left Great River to go to another company, or Great River was having a reduction of force? What was happening there, Doug?
Now my memory's not really wonderful, but I was, the reason I went there to Great River in the first place is that there was a layoff at Public Electronics, and for whatever reason, a year or two later, Republic was hiring again, and they were looking for, they called me, you want to come back? So I said, okay, I'll go. So I did. So I worked for REIC twice with this.
It sounds like you left Great River in order to go back to REI. Republic Electronics was located in what town, Doug? I should know, but I don't.
I want to say it was on Route 110, but I don't know. I'm pretty sure it was on Route 110. South of Huntington, what would it be? What would it be called? South of the Northern States, south of the expressway, but not all that far south.
Okay, a little bit south of Huntington, and the area you're talking about would be Melville or Farmingdale, to go a little bit further. I bet you they were in Melville. Is that true, Doug?
That's right, Melville.
Okay. So Great River. It's a mystery. To your knowledge, that company that was in Great River, although there was a portion of time in which it was Grumman Information Systems, but as a company in Great River, you think they were there for 5 years or 20 years? What's your guess as to the length of... I do remember the amount of installation, buildings, antenna ranges, whatever, at Great River. I'll bet you that company had at least 20 years of history. What do you think, Doug?
Oh, no, because I wasn't there for that long. One thing I do know is that they have, at one time before I got there, they were doing munitions, stuff that exploded. And I saw pictures of some of the stuff that they were doing out there. They had a grandstand at one point on their land.
Yeah, quite often, companies that do ordnance, exploding stuff, they do it in trenches and holes in the ground, not up on a grandstand. I'm trying to wonder. I guess you could take high-speed photography of something sitting up on a pedestal in order to look at the pattern that comes out of it after the explosion. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Doug.
As I say, I wasn't there when they were doing this, but I did see some photographs. And whether they took pictures from the grandstand or whether the grandstand was totally unrelated to the munitions, I have no idea. I don't think it was still there when I was there.
Okay. One last pass. Does anybody in the sound of my voice know the name of a company, an electronic company, doing some reasonably sophisticated work that 10 or 15 or so years ago, among other years, was located in Great River, Long Island? And what's the nearest town to Great River? That may also give us a little bit of a hint, Doug. Go ahead.
Don't really know, but I can tell you it's this plant was close to the Connecticut River. It was slightly west of the Connecticut River, and close to the place where Route 27 and Route 27A diverged.
Yeah, my recollection was that the Great River Company was south of Sunrise Highway, probably south of Montauk Highway, and you're saying close to the place where they merge. In other words, I don't remember seeing any of the Great South Bay from there, from Great River, but I bet you they weren't a powerful long distance from Great South Bay. What do you think, Doug?
Correct. I was looking, as I mentioned, I think I mentioned that I was looking on the Google Maps and Google Earth to see whether I could find the buildings, and I can't find them. And I think they tore them down, and it looks like there might be an athletic field or some kind of sports complex where that was. Like, I know you could easily walk at lunchtime over to the to a little tributary, at least, or something of the Connecticut River, a little small, like a large pond with a little island in it. It was some kind of an animal that used to walk at work, swim out there.
Maybe a beaver. So that's how you spent your lunch times at times, Doug? Go ahead.
We did that quite often, and there was another fellow, another ham there. I can't remember his call. His name was John Phillips, who was a graduate of Manhattan. And we'd go over sometimes to get a loaf of bread from the cafeteria and go over and feed the critter, whatever it was. I don't think it was a beaver. I think it was one other kind of animal was there. I don't even remember what it is, but we'd swim around in the water there.
I think there was a John Phillips that worked for AIL for a short period of time. I wonder if it's the same one, although with a name like that, it's possible there's more than one of them. Did John Phillips ever work for AIL?
He did, as a matter of fact. He's kind of a heavyset guy with reddish hair.
Yep, I may have run into him. We get into some pretty far-out subjects here on the TechNet. We can't call a DC to light. Cabbages and kings. Okay, you guys are about to get a really wild... What's the word for that? Go ahead, Lou, and Y2H, go ahead. What's the name of the company in Great River? You got it, Lou.
You know, I've been scouring the internet and I can't find it. I know that there's a server farm, you know, computers there, because I worked for a company years ago, a financial company, and I know that. I did want to say, I looked at the 60 Minutes overtime, about 5 minutes not aired, where they talked to the reporters and some of the people that were interviewed. And apparently there were dogs and pre-verbal children who were also affected, and that indicates that these categories do not participate in mass hysteria. Dogs and pre-verbal children.
I'm glad you brought that to our attention. I do remember that as part of the program. You can't call it psychosomatic anymore when other animals, as well as human beings, are being affected and getting sick. So there's something really going on here. The size and power of the hardware required to do this, assuming that the emitting surface is hundreds or thousands of feet away. That is a slim possibility. The emitting surface is in the exact same building, but I doubt that. I think it's being done from across the street, so to speak. So it takes a pretty big piece of hardware, a pretty high amount of power. And so if you had just one building where the people are being affected, and that one building is sitting in the middle of a great big open field, it would be almost impossible for this to happen. So it's got to be in a place that has multiple buildings, and some other building contains the hardware, is my guess. So, now, you saw it old time. Did you see the original article itself, Lou, NY2H, K2RIW?
Sir Roger, yeah, I did watch it.
Okay, glad you did. Did you also have the impression that 60 Minutes is really shining in this particular circumstance? In other words, they didn't do it in a way that's overly sensational. They had the raw material with many a not-so-qualified group of newscasters could make this a great big shouting over-enthusiastic. They did it in a rather reserved, rather professional manner, in my opinion. Did you get that impression in the original article, the edited article? Over to you, Lou.
I did, actually. And even in the overtime segment, you know, they said they went in with a lot of doubts, and they explored the mass hysteria, and as I just said, what they considered to counter it. One of the, as you remember, one of the fellas interviewed was doing, I guess you'd call it electronic countermeasures for the embassies or what have you. You know, so I think he probably pretty much aware of what's going on. Then they talked about the NSA admitting that these weapons existed, and even the Secretary of State, Pompeo, admitted to one or two as being a result of, you know, targeting. So that's what they're telling us. So imagine what they're not telling us.
Yeah, the main RF guy, the RF savvy guy, he was afraid to say it, but I am guessing he's one of these guys, I've met a few of them, who go around to embassies looking for the bugging devices. If you and I were an employee at a foreign embassy, the biggest thing you worry about is that your conversations among your fellow employees and your conversations back to your main country are not being secure. And so bugging devices is something you really got to worry about. And I've talked to people who had to hang on mountaineering equipment many floors in the air outside of a building in a foreign country at 2 o'clock in the morning with handheld instrumentation looking for the signals that indicate the presence of bugging devices within the building. Well, some of these guys are at the wildest occupation in the world, extremely high risk, and one of the guys that I've had a few conversations with who was doing that work for a few years on end ended up getting some very wild patents on things that eventually became what you and I know as RFID, RFID tags. Really started off, an RFID tag has a strong similarity with what used to be a bugging device way back in the dark ages of 30 years ago, so to speak. So I think that guy in that interview couldn't tell you that. I mean, he probably has the instrumentation by which he can measure the RF field. He has some kind of a field strength meter. Let me drop. I think he had a field strength meter, but didn't want to admit it. I think he didn't want to admit what he is hired to do. There's a whole bunch of reasons why he doesn't want to make that public. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. But he has the knowledge and the characteristics of these kinds of very adventurous guys that I've met on two occasions. So even though Dr. Roy thinks that this is quite possibly hokum and psychosomatic, there's a fair amount of evidence in the other direction, Roy. We may slowly swing you a little bit when it comes to affecting children, pets, I mean, dogs, children, and going on for lots of places, lots of time, lots of maladies. Mass hysteria becomes more and more difficult to use as an explanation. But Roy's not going to be spending his time on that one tonight. He's got a great puzzle for you that's going to bug the daylights out of you. Roy needs a lot of participation. Give him even crazy answers, because the real answer is crazy when you finally get it. AC2GS, with science talk and some great puzzles. K2RIW, you got it, Roy. AC2GS, I know that we forced you to run super high power last time. I could have told you, you could have cut back. You didn't need it. And I know that lowers your reliability when you run your equipment at the highest possible power. AC2GS, K2LIW, go ahead, Roy. I'm going to give one more call for Roy, and if not, we'll reverse the order of what's going on tonight. We'll then go to the space report while we're waiting for Roy to replace that fuse that may have blown on his equipment. AC2GS, if you're there, Roy. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Do you hear me, Dick?
Hearing you loud and clear. And so, did you have to replace the fuse? Over to you, Roy. You sound good. And don't run the high power. Use your equipment in a reliable manner tonight. You got it, Roy.
Okay, it was just set in the wrong position, and my trigger switch failed, so I had to replace that as well. So I'm checking the calendar, making sure it's not Friday the 13th. Last week, for anyone interested, I kind of went off suddenly. What happened was Anderson power poles have this flaw in them. If you don't disconnect them and reconnect them throughout time, they develop a little oxidation, they develop a little bit of a voltage drop and a resistance heat, and when I threw my afterburners on last week, it heated up the contacts and melted the plastic shell around them, and it expanded, relieving the spring tension that made the contacts. So the main connector failed, and I lost power. So I had to replace the connector, but all is well here. Let me drop, and I just want to repeat some comments that I thought I made, but I made them to a different frequency entirely. One sec. Okay, if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, there's a picture that Paul would like you to take a look at. There's a story behind it, which he'll tell you in the space report. In addition, I gave you a link to the 60 Minutes report, so you can watch it. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. And I just wanted to point out, I don't want to be a wet blanket, but in the Salem witch trials, one of the important of history, a lot of animals behaved very strangely and had sudden deaths and all kinds of curious things. So mass hysteria can involve people who are not verbal or non-people. Anyway, let me drop and I'll start the show. Okay, I want to, as always, tell people, if you have any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have any disagreements, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page for all the articles and anything else I feel that you might want to look at is set your web browser at roy.ac2gs.com, and that will give you the links and some pretty pictures. And as always, the chat room, chat.ac2gs.com. Also, I just wanted to mention that according to John, KC2, SHOIRLP is out. So keep that in mind. Let me drop, and I will give you my puzzle for tonight.
So to repeat, Roy, are you saying that IRLP on this system right now is inoperative?
Well, I know John, KC2SHO, can't connect his IRLP. Unfortunately, I don't have access to IRLP here. I can tell you how Echolink is doing. I can tell you how the chat room is doing. But the only way I can infer IRLP is what people tell me. And John at, I think, Lawrence Livermore, I forget exactly the lab he's working at, said that there's no IRLP feed for him this evening.
And I'm guessing he told you that by way of the chat room?
Yes, indeed.
And I've got on my notes here, I'll find it in a minute, as to the name of this beautiful research organization he works for. Go right ahead, Roy, K2RIW.
Okay, very well. space is a really popular subject with everyone. It seems to kind of light up the TechNet when I bring it up. That and black holes, well, black holes in space as well. People, not so much neutrinos. But, okay, so this is an astronomical question. We've all seen the solar system. You heard me talk about the heliocentric solar system about a year ago. I think I did a whole spiel about it. So my question to you guys is, in relation to planet Earth, for the most part, on average, which planet is closest to the planet Earth?
And Roy wants you guys to make a guess, so please give us a couple of guesses. Don't worry about it being wrong or crazy.
To SAY, I always think it's Venus.
Okay, one vote for Venus. Any other votes?
VDH, I'm going to say Mercury, but on average, it would be Mercury, but Venus does get closer when it does get close.
N2HVR, Mars at its closest approach.
Okay, I hate to play semantics with you guys. The question is, for the most amount of time, what's the closest planet? You've been sort of telling me what planet just kind of runs in there, tags base, and runs away. So once again, the question is, which planet is closest to us for the longest amount of time?
N2HVR, Mars.
Okay, I think I heard Hank as well.
Yeah, my guess is Mercury for the greatest average period of time, mean time.
Okay, so you agree with John. We have votes for Mercury, we have votes for Venus, we have votes for Mars. Anyone else want to give a guess? The only guess that won't be accepted is poor Pluto, because it's not categorized as a planet anymore.
WV2GXM, I'll play devil's advocate and say Jupiter.
Oh, Rich, I would love to play a game of poker with you. Any other ideas? Let them loose. You know, what the hell? It doesn't cost you anything.
Los Alamos Laboratory is SHO. Los Alamos, back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed, Dick. I should have remembered it. I knew it was a laboratory. It just evaporated from my head. So, once again, anyone with any other planets that they think are closest to our planet over time. Okay, well, I'll give you the answer. The answer is, and John and Hank had it right, it was Venus. So now let me ask you a little bit different. Which planet is closest to Mars most of the time?
By the way, Google disagrees with you.
Well, the article that was written up by astronomers disagrees with Google.
Roy, you just said Venus. Did you mean to say Mercury when it comes to the average closeness?
I'm sorry. I don't know. I had a brain, whatever. Yeah, it Mercury. I'm sorry.
Google agrees with you.
I'm glad we're in agreement. You know, sometimes I say the wrong voice. So the question now at hand is, what is the closest in time period, you know, on average, the closest planet to Mars now? Oh, come on, doesn't anyone want to just hazard a guess even?
It's got to be a planet, not a moon.
Yes, it has to be a planet, so it doesn't count either.
VDH, I'll say the Earth.
Okay, we have one vote for the Earth. Any other votes?
Oh, I'll use up all my cards and say it's Venus again.
Okay. Any other votes?
N2HVR, the Earth.
Okay. Any other votes? Okay, believe it or not, the closest on average planet to Mars is Mercury. Let me try again. What do you think the closest planet on average is to Jupiter? Come on, just guess a planet, you know, Jupiter. What do you think is the closest planet over time to Jupiter, might be?
Saturn, WB2GXM.
Very good, Saturn. Any other choices?
Oh, VDH, I'll also say Saturn.
Okay, any other choices? It seems to Saturn's in the lead here.
Yeah, I'm not going to say Mercury because it's probably a trick question.
Yes, Rich knows me far too well for this. The closest planet to the planet Jupiter over time is Mercury. Okay, well, I hate to beat a dead horse, but I'll beat it nevertheless. What planet do you think is the closest planet over time to Saturn?
Y2H, I think it's Mercury. I think because Mercury's orbit is so fast, it's very promiscuous.
Yes, Lou. The moral of this story is Mercury is the closest planet to every other planet in the solar system over time. Not necessarily because of its speed, but simply because of its closeness to the sun. And since all the planets are rotating around the sun, and Mercury is so darn close to the sun, it tends to be, over time, the closest planet to all the other planets, with the exception of Pluto, because Pluto has a kind of wonky type of orbit, but as we said before, Pluto is a planet, so it doesn't count. So the story is, and there was a nice little article, which I will point out at the link page, is that all the planets that our solar system spend the most time closest to Mercury. And that's tonight's bug.
In the case of Mercury and Earth, the average distance between Earth and Mercury is a smaller number than the average distance between Earth and Venus. If I now compared those numbers, average distance to Venus, average distance to Mercury, from Earth, are we talking about a 1% difference or a 50% difference? What's your guess as to the magnitude of the difference? Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
I haven't done the math, so I don't know for sure, but I think it's more than that. I did look up the distances of each of the planets this very night, just for people interested. And Mercury is, if people like astronomical units, one astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So Mercury is approximately 0.6 astronomical units away from us, whereas Venus is 1.2 astronomical units away from us. And if anyone's interested, Mars is approximately 2 astronomical units away from us.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, well, help is if you put that article on your website, because when you scroll down, yeah, you see all the math and everything. You could spend forever looking at that math. But they have that one animation going around, and you can see, like, you know, they'll have Mercury, Earth, and Venus, and you'll see them spinning around the sun. And you can almost count as they're going around. You know, Mercury keeps zooming around. Meanwhile, you know, Venus has traveled away from Earth, you know, in this animation, and you can tell it's like 100 million miles away. It's on the other side of the sun, and here comes Mercury zooming around every 88 days, So, you know, and that holds true for all the other planets. I think if they look at that animation, I think it's self-explanatory. It's better than doing the math, I think. Back to you, Rory.
Some people like math. Most people like illustration. So the link will be there. I didn't want to kind of expose it early because that would kind of ruin a little bit of the fun, although I don't think people kind of run to my link page immediately at 8 o'clock. But I promise you, the articles will be there. Any other questions or comments, or I'll move on to the usual stories.
A VDH with a comment?
What?
John.
Sign two.
Yeah, I remember also, however, when Venus makes its closest approach, of course it comes much closer to the Earth than Mercury does, but of course the question was on the spends the most amount of time. Okay.
Yeah, John, I try to make these things definitive. I realize that sometimes people don't kind of notice the way I phrase things. I tend to bend over backwards, hopefully, most of the time, by saying things as correctly as humanly possible. So, yeah, we're not talking about who tags base and comes the closest. We're talking, you know, hour for hour, day for day, what have you, is the closest planet to us. And in the case of every place, it's always good old Mercury.
The numbers I remember from a kid going to the Hayden Planetarium, I always remember Mercury was 33 million miles from the Sun, Venus an average of 67 million, and the Earth 93 million. And those are the numbers that always stuck in my mind as far as distances. But again, those are average distances. Good.
Yeah, they're average distances, but they're average with relation to the Sun. And as Paul mentioned, and the illustration will show everyone, we're not locked the way we are with the Moon. All the planets go around at their own rate. So even if our orbit was a mile away from another planet, which hopefully it never will happen, if that planet happens to be at the other side of its orbit, it's a big distance away. Even though the orbital distances are shorter, the actual relative distances between the two bodies is enormous.
Okay, I see. Yeah, thanks.
Hey, Paul, you wanted to say something?
No, what I said before was, I meant over long periods of time, of course. You know, you could have, for instance, you could have Jupiter in front of Saturn for a long period of time, and Mercury could be zooming around every 88 days. For that short period of time, of course, Saturn and Jupiter, you know, Jupiter would be closer to Saturn. But, you know, average over time, over long periods of time, of course, Mercury would always win out.
Yes, indeed, Paul. And by the way, someone came onto the chat room and says that it was Grumman that was at Great River, that he isn't familiar with any other big company that was in that area. So he thinks it was, let's see, he says, there were no other companies in Great River prior to Grumman. It was Westbrook Farm. Anyway, if there's no other questions or comments, I'll move on, but we're going to kind of highlight astronomy tonight. We'll do other things, but astronomy is in the news, so we'll mention some of it. So anyone with any other comments or questions about this particular subject? And also, in addition to the article that Paul mentioned, I'll give you a link to a nice YouTube where a guy... Yes, I believe, Lou, you got cut off there.
Okay. It's indeed a factor. And, Roy, I think you don't think it's a factor.
No, I it's not that I don't think it's a factor at all. I think it's a minor factor. If you sped up any of the other planets, it wouldn't really work. It's the combination of the speed and also of its incredible closeness to the sun. The two of them add to the effect.
Yeah, I guess we could blame some guy named Kepler. All righty, thanks.
Yes, Kepler. Kepler was a smart guy who figured out that planets do not travel in perfect circles as the Greeks would have loved it to be, but in ellipses. And Isaac Newton was a very smart guy who wrote a book to explain why the heck they travel in ellipses, because Kepler didn't quite explain it. He just theorized it.
Intuitively, it was fun. That was a good puzzle, because it is one of those things that, you know, your intuition doesn't point to them. So, very good.
Thank you, Lou. I mean, those are the things I kind of look for where the answer isn't, it just doesn't, you know, I'm not going to come here and say what's 1 plus 1, because, you know, everyone's going to say 2 and it's no fun. So it has to have a little hook to it, hopefully. I mean, one of these days, maybe I'll ask a puzzle that's obvious and see if anyone would fall for it that way, but not for the near future.
But we have to figure out a way to turn off the internet. It's too easy. I mean, I Googled it. I would not come on and answer a question based on a Google search, really. But that was the first thing that came up, and it came up highlighted, you know, the closest planet, so it was right there. So we got to shut down the internet during the TechNet. Can anybody arrange that?
I think the Russians are working just on that alone, and also the Chinese as well. Well, you're on your own best, you know, behavior. If you want to ruin it and look it up, I mean, if you want me to send you the answer ahead of time and ruin it for yourself, so be it. I think the interplay is enjoyable. Some people might not, so they don't play. So, you know, Google is your friend. I've always said that. I always will say that. A lot of times I hear people asking questions on the repeater. We are just typing the exact same words into a Google search. We'll give you 3,000 links to the same right answer. So I sort of agree that it's great to research, but this isn't really research. This is kind of let's exercise our brain cells a bit.
We'll take an oath. I think that's the thing to do. Alrighty, great stuff. Y2H.
Okie dokie. Well, in an astronomical vein, let's see. Celestial bodies can appear to do all kinds of confusing tricks. This very week, NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory captured a strange series of images in which the moon appeared to go rogue, crossing the sun as usual, but then briefly pausing to change direction. No, it's not a sign that NASA is faking it all and that the Earth is flat, but just an optical illusion familiar to all astronomers. The Solar Dynamics Observatory is currently in orbit around Earth, and it's not unusual for the NASA satellites to capture a lunar transit. The one observed on March 6, 2019, however, was unusual in that the moon appeared to move from left to right across the surface of the sun, which is quite normal. But then it paused for a moment in reverse direction, which is definitely not normal. This most certainly is not some kind of, it's not the kind of behavior you'd expect to see from the moon. An object locked in an immutable, unidirectional orbit around our lovely little Earth. But there is a perfectly rational explanation for this event. It's called retrograde motion. This optical illusion happens when a celestial object appears to move backwards because of the way that different objects move at different speeds at different points in their orbits, according to NASA. Writing in Earth Sky last year, astronomer Christopher Crockett described retrograde motion in this. He said, "You can test it for yourself. The next time you pass a car on the highway, as you approach a slower car, it clearly moving in the same direction you are. As you pull aside and pass it, however, from your vantage point, the car appears to move backwards for just a moment. Then, as you pull ahead of it, the car appears to resume its forward motion." Let me drop for a second. The same thing happens as Earth passes the slower-moving outer planets. When we pass Jupiter or Mars or Saturn, for example, these more outward planets in orbit, which move more slowly than Earth in orbit, appear to reverse course in our sky for a couple of months. In this case, the event lasted for just a few minutes rather than a couple of months on account of the Solar Dynamic Observatory's close proximity to the moon. So, rather than the moon changing direction, it's the changing vantage point of the Solar Dynamic Observatory as it orbits Earth that caused the visual effect. An animated GIF provided by NASA will be available as a link on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. As an interesting aside, retrograde motion messed up early astronomers who believed that the Earth was at the center of the universe. To explain the erratic behavior of planets falsely believed to be in orbit around Earth, these astronomers devised all sorts of explanations, including the idea that planets rotate around a moving point in their orbit. We talked about that when we were talking about heliocentrism. In addition to rotating around the Earth, it wasn't until the adoption of heliocentrism, the realization that the planets rotated around the sun, that the apparent back-and-forth movement of outer planets were finally understood. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. VDH with a comment. Yes, John.
Yeah, I know several of the astronomy picture of the day photos over the past year or two have shown time-lapse photos of planets being photographed night by night and moving, some then moving forward and then retrograde and then continuing forward as the orbital position or perspective changes. Okay.
I mean, although it's old hat for astronomers, it's there's a lot of people out there who are blissfully unaware of what a heliocentric solar system really means. If you asked a lot of people to explain why some planets seem to go in the wrong direction for a short period of time, they would just kind of shrug at you. But yeah, NASA loves those pictures, and like I said, I have a link to one where you can see the moon do the boogie woogie, if you will.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
That's one of the things early on when you're learning about astronomy, they teach you that, and some people will go out there with. It doesn't matter if it could be an inexpensive telescope, and they'd stare at Mars, they'd find Mars, and they would look at the star background, and over time you would see constellations. And then just when Earth starts, more or less moving in front of that planet, the next thing you know, you're looking at the planet and Mars in the background, and all of a sudden it looks like it's going backwards. And people used to draw that on the maps, when they're doing things, and you would spend like the better part of 3 or 4 months maybe doing something like that. It was a fun thing to do when you're learning. Back to you, Brian.
Yeah, I agree, Paul. I mean, it brings home the concept of a heliocentric solar system. To this day, I'm not quite sure exactly what flat earthers think of retrograde motion, although they probably think that that's fake as well. Who knows? But it's curious. But our next little story is about another planet gone retrograde. So if there's any other questions, feel free. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next one. Okie doke, the moon isn't the only thing that seems to be going in the wrong direction these days. Mercury is the planet closest to the sun, and it revolves around the sun in just 88 days. That's much faster than the Earth, which takes 365 days to make the trip. Rick Feinberg, a spokesman for the American Astronomical Society in Washington, suggests picturing Mercury as a race car in an inner lane and Earth in an outer lane. As they both make their way around the circular track, Mercury is going much faster and has a shorter distance to travel. Now, on to the issue of direction. If you watch the planets from the northern hemisphere, most of the time they appear to be going right to left. Over a period of several weeks, as seen against the starry background, Mercury is hard for us to see. It's visible only close to sunrise and to sunset. But three or four times a year, an optical illusion similar to the past one occurs. It looks as if Mercury is going backwards. It happens when Mercury is passing between the Earth and the Sun, leaving the Earth in its dust. That's Mercury's retrograde, and it lasts for about 3 weeks each time. The next one starts up in around July 7th. It's slapping us, basically, said Dr. Feinberg. It's coming around, and it's going to pass us. The visual effect is similar to when you speed up to pass another car, as we mentioned before. Let me drop for a second. But the curious thing is people think that it has something to do with their lives. Millions of otherwise sane people are fans of astrology. And for them, Mercury going in the wrong direction causes them to think that it will wreak havoc on their lives by the power of, I don't know, astrology? The National Science Board, which submits biennial reports to the Congress on the state of science and engineering in the United States, it includes attitudes towards pseudosciences, and it's found that younger Americans are less likely to reject astrology. In 2018, a report found that 54% of those 18 to 25 and 3% of those 25 to 34 said astrology was not at all scientific. Among all respondents, that number was about 60%. The Pew Research Center survey of American adults released just last year found that 37% of women and 20% of men said they believed in astrology. The numbers were highest among people ages 30 to 49, followed by those who were 18 to 29. Let me drop for a sec. Yeah, many people, of course, may peruse their horoscopes without embracing all the teachings of astrology, and having Mercury retrograde as a go-to phrase to describe why things are going wrong can be pretty useful to them. Mankind can be such a rational creature when it wants to be, but astrology is a shiny bauble we played with at the dawn of civilization. You would think that it was time we put away our ancient thinky and moved on. What can I tell you guys? Astrology. I don't understand it. Maybe you guys do. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2PN. Okie dokie. So much for my veiled comments about astrology and the irrational youth of our nation. I have some pretty pictures posted on my link web page, roy.ac2gs tonight. One of them, NASA has developed a new imaging technique that lets them capture for the first time the interaction of shock waves from two supersonic jets. They were taken by a new high-speed camera system developed to help NASA design a supersonic airplane that produces much quieter sonic booms. The jets shown in the image are T-38s flying at 28,000 feet. They were captured by a B-200 King Air flying a pattern just 2,000 feet above them, equipped with a 1,400 frame per second camera mounted on a very special arm. They show the shock waves or rapid pressure changes that result when an aircraft flies faster than the sound, which is about 682 miles per hour at 30,000 feet. The image was taken in black and white, but later colorized to show the relative air pressures around the shock waves. Let me drop for a second. What might be interesting is if you look at the rear of the T-38, you see that these shocks kind of interact in a curve. The research engineer Neil Smith said this is because the trailing T-38 is flying in the wake of the leading aircraft. So the shock waves are going to be shaped differently. This data is really going to help us advance our understanding of how these shocks interact, end quote. NASA has been able to image single shock waves for a while now using a technique called Schlieren photography, which takes advantage of the fact that light rays bend with changes in fluid density. Really loud sonic booms are produced when multiple shocks merge together, so NASA refined the technique so that it would work better with multiple shock waves. The imaging system is crucial to NASA and Lockheed Martin's development of the X-59 quiet supersonic technology X-plane. It's designed to reduce explosive sonic booms, which can cause damage over inhabited areas, down to a low level. Let me drop for a second. If such supersonic flights become legal over land, they'll change the face of air travel by reducing many trips by half. Several companies are working on quiet supersonic jet designers of one type or another. Boom has even taken deposits from airlines. Before any overland flights can happen, however, NASA will have to convince the FAA and other regulators that such planes won't cause damage by inhabitants below. Using images that dramatically illustrate that data, the new camera system represents a big step in that goal. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, Dolph, my second pretty picture for tonight is from the Hubble Space Telescope, which was just released. It just released some spectacular new cosmic eye candy there. This wild image that's on my website, roy.ac2gs, shows NGC 6052, a pair of colliding galaxies 230 million light years away. William Herschel first discovered this object in 1784 and thought it was a single galaxy. More recent observations have demonstrated that's not the case. It consists of two galaxies that are merging under influences of their gravity. Last imaged in 2015, this new observation presents a clearer picture of the objects using Hubble's Wide Field Camera 3 instrument. Now, each individual galaxy is clearly visible. It looks as if the spirals of one galaxy seen head-on are being observed by the other, viewed from the side. But one day, they'll merge so much that they'll be indistinguishable. Let me drop for a second. The image itself might look chaotic, but aside from the spectacle in the sky, anyone living in the galaxies themselves likely wouldn't face any danger. Stars and galaxies are so far apart that it's highly unlikely for anyone to collide with any other in a merger. It is possible, however, for some stars at the galaxy's outer region to be ejected. Galactic collisions could also reshuffle the stars, moving them further from or closer to the core of the new formed galaxy. Galactic collisions are a common event in the lifespan of galaxies. Scientists have hypothesized that our neighboring Andromeda galaxy experienced mergers of its own in its past. Perhaps the newest view of NGC 6052 will give you some hope for the future. Our own Milky Way is destined to collide with our neighbor, the Andromeda galaxy, according to astronomer simulations. That collision won't happen for another 4 billion years, so you got some time. But it would also be an incredible spectacle. Unfortunately, at that point, the sun will probably be too bright for Earth to support life, so it's all academic. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is Phil, AC2GS. Okay, Doug, my last pretty picture for tonight is a present, going away present from good old Opportunity. NASA's rover Opportunity may have shuffled off this mortal coil and joined the choir invisible, but will always have its data and banks of raw images. The mission team has now processed an incredible panorama from these files for their viewing pleasure. You can see one of them on my link, roy.ac2gs.com, and use the provided link to see it as well. Opportunity, along with its partner Spirit, launched in 2003 as part of the Mars Exploration Rover Program to study Mars' surface. Over nearly 15 years, it traversed more than 28 miles of the red planet before ultimately meeting during a planet-wide sandstorm last June. Opportunity gave us an understanding of what Mars truly looks like and found evidence that the planet was once wet. Let me drop for a sec. One important part of the mission was sharing images with the public as they came out, a practice that has now become standard for space agencies, and it has had a big impact on the way that we conceive of Mars. This latest panorama by a greatest hits of the red planet containing Mars's signature reddish rocks, the rim of Endeavour crater, pieces of Opportunity itself, and views of its track. The rover's panoramic camera, or PanCam, took the 354 photos in the image from May 13th to June 10th. NASA also produced a 3D vision version of the panorama, viewable through blue and red 3D glasses. Now, if you look at the raw images that came from Opportunity, you might notice that they're all black and white. The PanCam contains filters in order to view light as only in only one single wavelength or color. So these black and white images correspond to light received by the camera in only one color. For those images, the filters block out all light except for three wavelengths, 753 nanometers, which is near infrared, 535 nanometers, which is green, and 432 nanometers, which is violet. If you combine these three images by putting each one in a red, green, or blue color channel, you can see an approximate true color image of what Mars looks like. You can learn more about how NASA turns raw files into full color for the general public on its own website. Let me drop for a second. Opportunity might be dead, but there are tons of raw images left cataloging its incredible journey across the Martian surface. And if you want an excuse to brush up on your Photoshop operating skills, here are some nice graphic files to play with. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I wonder if you've ever looked at any of these 3D images from Mars. You know, I do have those colored glasses. I wonder if you've ever done that. It's pretty incredible when you do that.
I've never tried to. I've experienced that red-blue glass effect before, and I never found it particularly great, but I tend to have slight problems fusing images for 3D, so I just thought it was that. But I'll have to take a look. I'm sure I have a couple of blue paper glasses sitting around someplace in the shack, and I'll have to take a look at that.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You have the one picture with MU69, that one that New Horizons took a picture of. That they had that in 3D. A lot of Martian 3D pictures have been sent back. And I have a tough time with 3D as well. You know, one eye is off. You know, it's hard to get that 3D effect, but. You know, I think if I could see it, you know, anybody can. And, you know, maybe the improvements over the years have changed. You know, it's pretty clear.
Okay, I'll have to take a look. I mean, I still remember, I think the first time people used that red-blue glass trick was in the 50s in sci-fi or horror movies. Maybe that's what gave it a bad name. But, like I said, I've tried it before, and it gives me a mild headache, and it wasn't the most enjoyable thing. But I still have the glasses somewhere, so I'll take a look.
Okay. I like the ones where, you know, you just see, like, the front end of the rover, and then it looks, at, you know, looks out to the horizon. Those are very good. All right, well. If anybody has those glasses, the red and green glasses, it's worth it. You know, you bring up in Google, you put in Mars rover 3D, and you'll get 100 pictures.
Okay, very good, Paul. Anyone with any other comments before I move on to a different topic entirely? President Donald Trump announced this past week that the Federal Aviation Administration would order all Boeing 737 MAX 8 and MAX 9 planes grounded in the U.S. following last Sunday's plane crash in Ethiopia that killed 157 people and an October crash in Indonesia that killed 189. The U.S. is the last major country on this planet to ground the planes. Quote, Boeing is an incredible company. They are working very, very hard right now, and hopefully they'll very quickly come with an answer, but until they do, the planes are grounded. End quote. President Trump said, he added that the FAA would